Work moves fast. Every email, report, and proposal counts. That's where Grammarly comes in. It's your one place to think, write, and finish. Grammarly's AI agents help you find natural phrasing, fine-tune tone, and confidently write wherever you work. It's the premier writing tool that 93% of users trust to get more work done. In a world of generic AI, don't sound like everyone else. With Grammarly, you never will. Download Grammarly for free at Grammarly.com.
Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed Unfiltered. We have a new name for this weekly show, don't we now, Meethal and Colin?
Yeah, we do.
We do, yes. How are you guys, by the way?
Doing well.
Doing well, yeah.
How's 2026 turning out for you so far?
So far, so good. Easing in.
I have all my fall and winter grades in, started my spring semester, so things are looking up.
I can't believe, Colin, you are back in class already. I thought you would have more of a break because I'm not ready. I have not quite transitioned into work mode yet because I just got back from my vacation a few days ago. But yes, we are now Undisclosed Unfiltered for these kind of addendum-ish episodes because it turned out we were going with Sidebar, Undisclosed Sidebar. And it turned out, of course, great minds think alike, that Susan Simpson has a series called Sidebar.
Obviously.
For her podcast. Obviously. So you know what? Just humor us here as we flail through this, and it'll be, regardless of what it's called, is going to be interesting every week. And you know, this week, well, first of all, you know, we dropped our first unfiltered episode last week, and apparently, so there are some comments and questions and some things that arose. So we thought we would talk about those before we got into the stories that we want to talk about this week.
Yeah, actually, we got a couple of comments. One comment was related to the case that Colin brought up about the whole Scotland not guilty option. One of our listeners asked the question, does anyone know with the laws as they were in Scotland, if the consequence is anything different than if it was a not guilty verdict? Seems to me like it would make sense if it was kind of a way to get around double jeopardy.
Yeah, I was literally just discussing with my students in my wrongful convictions class last night. And so not guilty and not proven under Scottish law had the same result. In other words, the defendant could not be re-prosecuted. Double jeopardy did apply. And so Scotland has now gotten rid of not proven, but yeah, it used to mean the same thing legally as not guilty. The question is being the stigma to the defendant of, we think you're guilty, but the prosecution didn't prove it.
But it had the same effect in terms of you could not be re-prosecuted for the crime.
Absolutely.
It was done.
Right.
Okay. That's good to know.
The other comments were related to my case about the mother who had her child kidnapped. A lot of users were talking about, you know, this whole faux kidnapping thing. How is that any different from these institutions, behavioral institutions, for example, that have their child kidnapped at night or early morning hours and taken to whatever facility because they have behavioral issues? Is that not kidnapping also? Some other people were talking about, well, there's an endless number of what ifs, right? So many other things could have happened. The mother could have never made it there. You know, the kidnappers could have decided to do whatever they wanted to instead of the plan that was discussed. So a lot of conversation around that as well.
Well, I'll say as to the what ifs, I mean, factually, anything could have happened, but legally, what matters is what actually happened, right? Not what could have happened, I believe, right, Colin? But also, like, I mean, and by the way, this is a real thing. If you don't know about this, that there's been documentary, I can't remember the documentary that came out about this. I was blown away about these institutions that in the middle of the night will go and kidnap your children. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, basically locked up. They're completely isolated. They cannot contact their families. It's for behavioral reasons. It's really horrific. Mm-hmm. And they're making so much money doing it. Did you guys watch
these? Oh, I watched. Of course.
Yeah, like Paris Hilton, right? She's testified against this because I think that happened to her as a kid.
Oh, I didn't know about the Paris Hilton. Oh, yes. Yeah, I did read about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I saw something about it.
I can't remember the name of the documentary, but...
I know what you're talking about. I can't think of the name of the producer either.
Yeah. But yes, and I started following the producer too after I watched it, because I'm like, wait, what happened? Because she went back. It was a really well-made documentary. This is so sad. We should look it up as we're talking. Maybe, Mithal, you can... Actually, let me see if I can Google it while we're talking. But I think the difference, look, I think they're both, I think that is maybe even more horrific in many ways, because it's like a prolonged incarceration detention of the child, whereas this was kind of a really dumb way to teach her a lesson to be careful. But the difference here, I think, is that, like, why would the mother be prosecuted versus, like, those institutions that are not prosecuted? I don't know. What do you? I feel like maybe the difference is because the child was an imminent. I don't know. Was an imminent danger. I'm not quite sure. Colin, what do you think?
I just wonder how much impact the child being on the autism spectrum had. Right.
Oh yeah.
I think that probably played a big role, and I guess it also leads to the question of, and this is what I think Paris Hilton was testifying against, is that these institutions have been deemed lawful, and so. This is part of a recognized process, and I think that's what Paris Hilton was testifying to, is let's make this unlawful because now, because it's permissible, the parents can't be prosecuted.
Because it's not, but then I do think it's a fair kind of a comparison, though, to what happened here, right? I mean, is what the mother did unlawful, specifically?
Yes.
Is it? I mean, really, is it?
To have your kid kidnapped and not...
But it's not a real kidnapping, right? It's not a real kidnapping. The whole thing was a setup. Right. I mean, you could even say it was kind of a prank in a way.
It's a kidnapping because it's against the kid's will, even if it's not against the parents' will. Whereas in the other one, it's part of the process of taking them into this treatment facility, which currently is lawful. I'm not sure whether... what Paris Hilton was seeking was passed or not. That might be banned now.
Well, by the way, the documentary series is called The Program. If you haven't watched it, watch it.
You have
it's
to watch it.
Nuts. It's nuts. But I think this is a great question, and I have to think about it more, because I feel like, I don't know. I think this is where I don't how I felt about this story the first time around. I thought, I know, Colin, you said that you were okay with the mother getting some prison time. I was not okay with it, because I just don't think there was any malicious intent. I don't think that she was trying to hurt her child. She really thought this was going to help her child. And there should be some consequence, but I don't know, prison. And then, like, where's the child? Who's the child going to be with? It's an autistic child. I don't think that child wanted their parent to end up in prison. Anyhow, we don't have to rehash the story, but thank you. Is that it? Or any other comments or questions we want to discuss?
That was the gist of the questions. Some listeners did agree with your take on it of, not necessarily the greatest way to go about, doing a faux kidnapping of your own child, but she doesn't necessarily deserve to be behind bars. So...
Well, look, I was away for the first 2 weeks of this year, and the entire time I was gone, I was like, what is happening in the United States of America? I was overseas, and I had this guy who was a tour guide, was like, why are you guys kidnapping the presidents from other countries? I was like, holy crap, what did I miss? And then, so a lot has happened. There's plenty of stories that I could have picked from to talk about, but there's one in particular. So, I mean, I can start us off today, unless you guys, one of you want to jump off.
It.
All right. I want to talk about the killing of Renee Good. And I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with this. On January 7th, Renee Nicole Good, who was a 37-year-old U.S. citizen, mother of three, was shot and killed by an ICE agent in South Minneapolis. It was fairly early in the morning. She had just dropped her six-year-old off at school. She had gone to this. There was a protest happening. There was like this huge, massive operation that is continuing to happen in Minneapolis specifically. And at that time, there's like 2,000 ICE agents right now or federal agents in Minneapolis, which is insanity to me. But anyhow, so she shows up in this one neighborhood as a legal observer. She's there with her wife, Rebecca Good. And they were just there to like kind of watch. But, you know, what we know from what we've seen from the footage, like I haven't seen extended footage. I think everybody's seen the same footage, which is maybe the last minute or two of her life, which is that she's in her car. She's like in an SUV. And there's different ICE agents kind of surrounding her on one side. And it sounds like there are different commands being thrown at her. Like she's being told to get out of the car, but also to get out of there. And there's, you know, body cam footage from one of the officers. She looks up, she's like, I'm not mad at you. Look, you know, dude, I'm not mad at you. And then she just starts to drive off. But one of the ICE agents shoots and fires at her and hits her in the face. I mean, like multiple times. And so that's, I mean, like it seems pretty clear what happened. But the response, of course, has been completely politicized on both sides. Renee was killed on the spot. And the agent who killed her, his name was Jonathan Ross. And, you know, so the federal take on this, the administration is like, well, look, she was they literally called her a domestic terrorist. And they said they're saying that she's a paid agitator. I mean, J.D. Vance, the vice president, said that we want to know who's funding her. Like, who is funding these people? I mean, you know, she was just a mom who showed up. Like so many, there's thousands of people showing up these protests and also to help protect like these neighborhoods from ICE agents. And there's obviously not a funding stream that's paying these people to show up. Kristi Noem described the act as domestic terrorism. I mean, the feds have tripled down and said they're circling the wagons. J.D. Vance is like, look, this agent, like we owe him a debt of gratitude, as if she was like an imminent threat to anybody. But the response from local authorities is completely different. You know, the governor, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz was like, first of all, him and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey were like, you know, we want ICE to get the F out of our state. But they're like, you know, it's all bullshit. It's garbage. The video shows that she was not a threat, that the officer was not in any danger, and you know that this it was like she was killed unlawfully. And so what happened since then is that like there's an investigation being done, and I put this in quotes because apparently the Department of Justice has taken over the investigation. The FBI has taken over, and they have removed Minnesota has something called the BCA, which is a Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and they investigate these types of incidences, and they were conducting a joint investigation, but the FBI federal officials removed them from the investigation. And the BCA, which again is the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, was like, well, we are shut out of any of the evidence. We have no idea. The FBI has been collecting evidence. We have access to none of it. So, you know, but given that, like literally, I don't know if it was the day of the shooting or the day after when all the administration officials stood up and said she's a terrorist and the officer was well in his right. I mean, this is all being said before there's an investigation, right? There's no investigation. So I feel like I don't really have a lot of faith in the investigation when they already know that they have to reach a certain conclusion, right, to appease this administration, right? What do you guys think?
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that anybody is commenting on she's X or she's Y in terms of labeling her or saying that the ICE agent did what he was supposed to do. You haven't finished your investigation yet. Aren't you not supposed to say anything until you're done?
Yeah, I mean, it really seems, and this happens so much nowadays, it gets litigated in the press and the media, social media, before the investigation is done. And yeah, I mean, I haven't followed this too closely, but it seems like for a few days there was a new video, and I think the one you mentioned, Rabia, I think it was actually his cell phone and not his body cam. I don't know if cam footage yet, so everything just seems premature to me, but I don't know if we're going to have transparency in terms of how this investigation is proceeding. Again, yeah, it seems like people on opposing sides have formed their views, and I just hope there's some more transparency so we can actually see what's going on.
I mean, I want to talk about, like, potentially, because a big debate right now, and you know, the vice president said the very next day, it was the very next day at a press conference, he said, ICE agents have absolute immunity, not even qualified, but absolute immunity. He cannot be prosecuted. Nothing can, you know what I mean? He was well within his right and he is protected legally from any kind of charges. So the question, there's that question, right? Of like, you know, and I want to talk a little bit about that, whether or not that's actually true. But there's just so many layers to this. And one of the most important ones, I think, is, I mean, obviously, you know, look, Renee was a mother of three. She was an award-winning poet. She had moved to Minneapolis not too long ago. She had lost her second husband a couple of years ago and was newly married and had moved. I mean, the whole thing is awful. And her wife was right there in the car with her when this happened. But the fact that this woman, who is a U.S. citizen, who, as far as I know, has no criminal record, is being called a domestic terrorist, is really worrisome to me.
And that too for protesting, right? It's not like she was doing anything physical.
She wasn't even she was in her car.
I mean, she was, yeah, she was around.
She was observing.
Traffic. Right.
And so, and there's a difference between the people who show up as legal observers and people who are actually out there, like, you know, protesting, which of course is also your constitutional right to do so. But labeling like that as an act of terrorism is, you know, look, the PTSD from post 9/11, you know, how the American Muslim community was treated after 9/11 is still real. And this is a very delayed, like, remnant of that era, where it's not hard for any administration to say X is terrorism. And because terrorism is such a vague, I mean, legally, it's like so vague to define it, but they can label almost anything as either terrorism or material support of terrorism, and then say that, you know, their actions are justified. But also, like, the chilling effect it has then on society to be able to go out and exercise the constitutional rights. I mean, to me, the way the administration is tripling down is not just shameful vis-a-vis this particular case, but I think it's, I also feel like it's a bit of a threat. Like, people beware. Like, if you show up to one of these things, we're going to consider you a domestic terrorist. And if you get killed, then you get killed, because our agents have full right to do that.
Yeah, it's like the fear factor. Do you want to go? Do you not want to go? Like, you may or may not get shot. It doesn't matter what you're doing, right? It's not even like you're causing commotion. I could just be standing there.
Yeah. Vice President Vance's comment about absolute immunity. I mean, that's legally completely wrong. Absolute immunity is a judge who's ruling in a criminal or civil case, or a legislator's enacting legislation or voting a certain way. In those functions, you have absolute immunity.
Yeah.
ICE would have qualified immunity, which is what applies to police officers, FBI agents, et cetera, doing these investigations.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, like, he's wrong about the absolute immunity thing, because it is for, like, very high level, like judges or legislators or high level officials. So they can, like, you know, they can do their jobs without fear of repercussion. But in this case, whether or not this agent has, or any agent would have, qualified immunity, kind of, it seems like, depends, I guess, is in a way, like, it would have to be tested case by case in court. So it seems like what's happening is, even though the FBI has shut out the state from the investigation, the state is like, we're still going to go ahead and try it. Well, they're starting their own investigation. So this happened in Hennepin County, and the county attorney is Mary Moriarty, and the AG of Minnesota is Keith Ellison. Keith Ellison, I've known him since he was in Congress, and I believe he was on the 45th with Susan and I once. I can't remember.
He was, right? Yeah.
Oh, he was on Undisclosed, too. That's right. Like, yeah, he was on Undisclosed. So we've known Keith Ellison for a while, but they're like, you know, they have been They haven't made it. I mean, I don't think they've made it super political, but they have been like, we are going to start our own investigation. They even launched a public portal where people can submit like witness statements or any other evidence, because they're like, they have to gather the evidence independently because the FBI will not give it to them. And they're like, well, right now we are going to continue to gather evidence and then decide whether or not we are going to bring charges. So, one question I have for you, Colin, you have seen the video footage I'm sure everybody's seen, right? Is that not evidence enough?
I mean, it's evidence enough where they could bring a state prosecution, right? I mean, there's various angles we see. I think there was even an overhead shot that showed the movements over a longer period of time. So that's all they need to bring it to try. I mean, you can ask a jury, here are various pieces of footage, decide for yourself, is this involuntary manslaughter or was it self-defense? I mean, that's enough by itself. Obviously, they'd want more information to facilitate that process. But what they have just out there now would certainly be enough to bring charges and have a trial.
Yeah. I mean, what they don't have, obviously, is like access to, for example, the windshield, seeing like what angle the shots came in, those kind of the autopsy report. I mean, these kinds of things are important, like where exactly was she struck? And then there's a question of what happened afterwards. After she struck, you know, there was a medic who was like in the crowd, or doctor, and he's like, let me come, and they wouldn't let him come. And then they moved her before they let medics arrive. Like, what happened afterwards was also, although it's likely she was killed on the spot, but certainly they obstructed, it seemed like they obstructed efforts to get medical attention to her afterwards. But apparently, so what can happen now is that if they decide to bring charges, if they bring state charges, what this agent can do is he could actually have the case removed to a federal court, apparently. This is what legal experts are saying. I'm not a legal expert, even though I'm a lawyer, but Colin, you might know better. So apparently that is one thing that federal agents and federal officials can do, is they can, if they're charged in state, they can have it, they can petition to have it moved to a federal court. And then in the federal court, the judge is going to decide whether or not the qualified immunity applies. And there's like several tests for that. And then we see, but also, you know, the family could also file for like civil damages and stuff like that under the Federal Tort Claims Act. Apparently, there, it's not that, you know, what J.D. Vance said is not completely true, is basically what we want to say. You know, like it's the ICE agents, federal agents cannot just kill people with absolute immunity. It's not, that's not true. And I think one thing that makes like is really important, like a really important lesson from all of this, is how important it is that we constantly, we always have bystander footage, that when these kinds of incidences are taking place, when there are protests, that you have not just legal observers, you have people taking, like just videotaping everything, because that's like the evidence at the end of the day.
Right.
Let's see, anything else I want to talk about here?
Well, I actually, I was listening to an interview of the police chief. And he was talking about how, you know, he came in after George Floyd and there were so many instances. And he's like, I've been for years trying to win back the community's trust and, you know, show them that, you know, we've done everything that we can do on our end to make sure that we've got the good cops, and the good cops understand they're staying in line and, you know, kind of doing all the right things, de-escalation and all of that. And then something like this happens and just everything is just blown out of the water, and we've got to start all over again, even though we weren't the ones that did it. And we're trying to work alongside the ICE agents, but they're working independently, you know?
Yeah. At the end of the day, this is going to be a showdown, I think, state by state, between states and the feds. You know, Minnesota, like they have sued, the state of Minnesota has sued the federal government to get ICE out of the state completely. I don't see that going their way, but I don't know how this is going to go, but I feel like this is going to be a state by state showdown. And I think it's fascinating that the party of states' rights suddenly thinks states' rights are not important in this particular context. But yeah, anything else, Colin, you want to add, or you guys, you want to add, but other than like you're talking about this discussion, because we have to see what's going to happen, how this is going to go down. All right. All right. Then let's move on. Let's see. I will popcorn this over to Mito.
Okay. I have a case out of North Carolina. So the morning of January 3rd, a woman in North Carolina, Zoe Welsh, calls 911, stating that a man broke into her house, threw a brick into her window, and that's how he got in. She's seen him before, apparently, at a nearby park because he's homeless. Now, she's able to give all that information to the operator because upon entering her house, he goes to the kitchen into the fridge to get something. Then eventually he finds her in the bedroom and proceeds to hit her with a brick until, you know, she's hemorrhaging from the left side of her head. The police officers show up to the house, find her already deceased in her bedroom, and end up arresting this 36-year-old man whose name is Ryan Camacho. He's been charged with murder and felony burglary, and later this month, he's due in court. Now, Camacho has a history of crimes dating back 20-some years, ranging from misdemeanors to violent felonies, and just as recent as a month ago, he was in a detention center for about 4 months due to a string of felonies. Court documents showed that he had a history of mental illness, so the judge ordered an evaluation to make sure that he was competent to stand trial. And ultimately, the evaluator says, quote, she was unable to determine his capacity to proceed. So the judge agrees, and the case was dismissed. He was released because the judge didn't think he was a danger to himself or to society. Clearly, he was wrong. So, you know, there are plenty of cases like this. And so this case triggered the question once again about the workings of the criminal justice system and the mental health system and kind of how that overlaps. And how do we prevent something like this from happening again? You know, do we need a mental health court, a different set of judges to hear cases, you know, related to people who have mental health history, or a panel of judges that's including a mental health professional? Obviously, you know, there's advocacy, there's bills and things like that. But, you know, how can we better determine whether somebody needs to be behind bars for the crime or in a mental health facility? So I just thought that was interesting and kind of that discussion, because it does come up time and time again. But, you know, in that state, there are individuals who are trying to work together with the governor and the mayor to try to, you know, introduce some kind of bill to get the two systems to find an intersection where they can have some type of solution. They don't know what that solution is. And I think that's why they're bringing kind of different parties together. Currently in North Carolina, they do have, like, the police has a unit where I think it's called the Acorns Unit. That unit goes to you know, homeless people on the streets, and they say, hey, we can take you to this facility and get you some help and support. But if they don't want to go, they don't have to go. So then you can't force them to go, right? You can't take them, you know, just grab them and take them because you think they need it. So it's like, then you're still running the risk of maybe something else is going to happen and a crime like this could happen. And, you know, in this case, it did. So, you know, what can we do, or what are your guys' thoughts? Yeah.
Colin, what are your thoughts? I have lots of thoughts, but
Robbie's like, I'm still jet lagged.
No, I have thoughts. I have thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. Going back to the judge deeming him incompetent to stand trial. So that's a test under the due process clause. And it looks at whether the defendant is able to understand the nature of the proceedings against them. I know I'm being prosecuted for this crime. I'm not on a reality TV show, et cetera. And can they assist in their own defense? Can they help their lawyer with trial strategy, et cetera? And if, and this, at least in the federal system, I'm not sure about North Carolina, but in the federal system, as long as there's a pending trial, the judge has jurisdiction. And if they think this defendant's a danger, they can have them in a mental health facility, locked up, house arrest, treatment, et cetera. Once that judge declares this individual incompetent to stand trial, that criminal judge loses jurisdiction and isn't able to do anything because there's no longer a pending trial. And it creates this really weird gap where now we have to have a whole separate process to see whether they're institutionalized, et cetera. And a lot of cases get lost in those cracks. And that might have been what happened here. I'm not sure because each state has its own rules. But that's, at least in the federal system, a big gap that exists now, and there needs to be more harmony.
Yeah, I am really confused about the process here, because it's like, okay, you have somebody that has, you know, some serious mental health issue, and then they commit, let's say, an act of violence. They're not competent to stand trial, but clearly that, you know, they have a history of either harm to others or self-harm, maybe. So unless there is a process to then turn them over to some kind of, you know, so they can get treatment, that's it. They're just like, that's it. It just gets, it's, they just get put back out. I'm like, you know, is that what you're saying, Colin? Like, yeah, that's the crack?
Now you could have a civil commitment, but again, that's a separate process that has to start, that's beyond what that criminal judge can do who is handling that prosecution.
And a civil commitment requires what, like a either court appointed guardian or like a family member or somebody who's going to start that process, right? Like that doesn't,
yeah,
it doesn't happen without somebody, like, you know, actually petitioning. Yeah, somebody has to petition for that. Okay. So, you know, here's, I mean, it's one of those things where I think it's like, it's a real double-edged sword, because there's a lot of stigmatization around mental illness, and that, you know, mentally, people with mental illness are dangerous, are inherently more violent, this and that. Like, you know, we have to be careful because the statistics don't bear that out necessarily. And we don't want to stigmatize folks that have mental illness. But at the end of the day, you know, I think it is impossible to prevent people from committing crimes and committing violence. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, whether a person is mentally ill or really angry or a psychotic or just violently criminal, right, in their nature or whatever, or is having a bad day, like, people will commit crimes. And the question is then, what are the systems in place to address that? And it seems like here, I never thought about the fact that what happens when somebody's held incompetent to stand trial. Like, I never even considered, like, what happens to that defendant then.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean they didn't do what you said, you know, what they're being charged with.
Exactly.
It just means, right, like, this is, it's, that's crazy. And this is the kind of, you know, it's like, it's a big problem also, because this is not the kind of thing that, you know, you can pass a law and it just applies to everybody. Every state is going to have to deal with this, like, separately. And I don't know. I've just never heard of this particular issue being addressed, like, at the state level.
Yeah. On the opposite side, it's interesting because I taught this recently in my plea bargaining class. In the Bronx, in New York, the Bronx defenders do what they call holistic criminal defense. And that is, when a client comes in, they have a criminal matter, they collaborate with mental health professionals, housing attorneys, and they address the client as a whole, all the issues they're facing beyond just their criminal matter. And there was a report a few years ago saying, oh, this holistic defense is wonderful because it links all these things together. The question would be, could we have holistic prosecution where prosecutors are collaborating with all the other actors in the system to make sure this is being handled appropriately?
Yeah. And that's just that one little jurisdiction. That's just the Bronx. I mean, like, that's how many counties are there in America, you know what I mean? So duplicating that. But that's a terrible, terrible case, Vito. But anyway, thanks for bringing that to our one more thing we got to fix in the criminal justice system. Great. Colin, what do you want to talk about this week?
Yeah, so my story that I came upon recently was, we now have the youngest attorney in California history. Her name is Sophia Park. She passed the California bar exam at age 17 years,
Holy
eight
crap.
Months old.
Wow.
Guess whose record she beat?
I don't know. Yours, Colin?
I would not have been prepared to be a lawyer at 17. But no, she beat her brother's record, her brother Peter Park, who had passed the bar exam at 17 years and 11 months old. They both in Tulare County
Hold. Okay. To sit for the bar, did they not have to go to law school? Are you saying they got through law school?
They went to law school by 17? 13 years old in law school.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
And they both are now working for the DA's office. And Sophia said, I wanted to work for the prosecution because I like the idea that I get to represent the people of the state of California, keep our community safe, and make sure that justice is served. So my question is, on the one hand, if you have precocious teenagers, obviously very intelligent, driven, hardworking, should we allow them to become attorneys slash prosecutors? Or, as we said in our Amanda Lewis series, to be a juror, deliberating in a case, you had to be at least 18, right, sometimes older in some jurisdictions. Is it right to have? And we've had all these discussions about the development.
Brain development.
Brain development, yeah, and juveniles, and why we have these changes to juvenile life without parole. Is it dangerous to have, you know, Doogie Howser, J.D., these teenagers who are now prosecuting cases in California? So what do the two of you think? Is this fine if they're good enough to pass the bar in law school at age 17? Or should we have a minimum age to be an attorney?
Listen, I have a 17-year-old right now. And I am telling you for sure that that 17-year-old is not the average 17-year-old. I don't think there's a danger necessarily of, like, immature 17-year-olds overrunning the criminal justice system. These guys clearly are outliers. Like, I'm guessing their IQs are super high. Now, I don't know the correlation between, like, IQ and, like, brain development in terms of, like, maturity and all those things. But have you met some of the prosecutors in our cases? I mean, really, I feel like...
Prompts the question, could they do worse than some of the prosecutors out there?
Right. I'm not opposed to it. I feel like if they've got the chops, I mean, what I would hope is that, you know, they are being mentored well, mm-hmm, you know, as young attorneys, and not necessarily being put out in the field and just handed cases to handle on their own immediately. I'm assuming that's true. But if I was an attorney in that office and these two kids walked in, I would just hate my life. I would just feel so insecure. And I'd be like, get them out of it. I don't know. That's crazy. I did not hear anything about this. Crazy. And are their parents attorneys? Or any of their parents attorneys?
I don't know what their parents are. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure if it's said in the article. Mitha, what are your thoughts? Too young, or they should be allowed to do it if they can pass the bar?
Both. I do think they're too young, but I mean, if they've passed the bar and they've checked all the boxes, then they earned it. So I do think they should be able to practice. But I agree with Rabia in that they should have a mentor. They should maybe be teamed up with, you know, a more seasoned lawyer initially, because not only are they lacking maturity, they're probably lacking a lot of just life experiences, right? And so they may not have that broadened view or experience that somebody seasoned has, even if it's somebody who's been a lawyer for 5 years and started at 35. You know, just life experience is not necessarily in the legal system itself. So, but I mean, yeah, they earned it.
What's your take, Colin?
When I was in law school at William & Mary, we had a 1L in our class who I think was 16. Okay. And it didn't go well.
Oh,
I've started to see some applications to South Carolina this year. Teenagers applying to law school. And I don't want to take away the opportunity of someone who's very precocious and advanced and can do it. What I've seen in applications and this classmate we had at William & Mary, it leaves me skeptical. And I'm concerned. I think it can be case by case, and maybe these kids are extremely mature, but I'm concerned.
I want to hear more about your classmate.
Like,
I get that. But like, in what ways did it not go well? Was it that like it was kind of like what was being taught was kind of beyond comprehension at that age, or what were, in what way?
Lack of life experience, socialization skills. I think they were very sheltered in their childhood and upbringing. And that might be different in the case of the Park siblings, but just not able to handle both the social and the life experience aspects of it.
And yeah. I mean, I can see that being a bigger thing, especially now with social media and teenagers in general, right? Like, no matter how smart you are, how are you utilizing social media? How influenced are you? You know, whatever the case might be.
Yeah, I think, you know, they might be technically brilliant and maybe they're able to, like, you know, but it's not just about like checking those boxes. When you are practicing law, obviously you have to know the law, but and you have to, there are boxes you have to check, but you also have to be able to think more holistically, contextually, make calls that are sometimes really close. I mean, just look at like the Renee Good case, right? Like you have there's a lot, but I'm assuming, like I said, that the DA's office will be smart enough not to be like, here's your case, load by, right. And, yeah. and take off. But that's interesting that you're seeing these kinds of applications. Are you on the admission committee, Colin?
Yeah, I'm on the admissions committee at my law school. So I.
Oh, okay. My daughter's going to call you in a few years.
Review the files. And for those listening who are applying to law school, and Rabia, you might recall this from taking the LSAT, the exam to enter law mm-hmm. school. In addition to the formal exam, they give you a writing prompt.
Yeah.
And you have to write a response to this writing prompt. It's, you know, it's a startup business has these five options, and which option should it choose? A lot of people just sort of blow it off and do like a nonsense response. But actually, at least for me and some people on my committee, because of generative AI, because those personal statements might not be the work of just the applicant, but
yeah.
mentors, like that's the one chance I get when I'm screening files to say, this is actually this applicant writing something. And I can mm-hmm. judge that to judge their writing and analytical skills. And so if you're taking the LSAT,
oh.
really think about writing a good response to that LSAT writing prompt.
Oh, that's great advice. That's good. That's the one place the kid can't ChatGPT it, because my daughter ChatGPTs everything. Everything. It's really concerning.
I put my law school exam in the fall into it, and it got a score of 12 out of 100. So I felt pretty good about that. That I'm sure in a few years it'll catch up to it.
Wait, say that again. Say that again.
I put my fall exam for law school into ChatGPT
okay.
to get a response, and the response
oh,
I scored
how, oh.
is 12 points out of 100. And so I felt pretty good that, you know, I know
failed.
AI is coming, but I'm a few beats ahead of it at this point.
No, nice. Have you seen? There's a trend on social media where they're trying to get AI to spell to be like how many R's are in the word? I think it was strawberry. Like this guy had to try like 6 times and it kept saying, there are 2 R's. It would spell out the word and then say, mm-hmm. as you can see, there are 2 R's. Clearly there are some gaps in AI still. But that's it. Now I'm going to go look up those kids and hate on them. But thank you, Colin, for bringing that to my attention. All right. Well, these are some great stories. By the way, guys, if you want, I'm like on social media, you can reach out to us on our Facebook group. You can reach out if there's other things, if there's, you know, stories you want us to talk about or cover, we'd be happy to do that as well. And look forward to hearing your thoughts about like the stories that we talked about today. So I think that's it for us this week, right, guys?
That's it.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will be back next week as we barrel through, 2026. I already feel like it's been a really long year, but too early for another vacation, unfortunately.
Pace yourself.
Pace myself. Yes. All right, guys. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you next week.
See you guys.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support, and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.